Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good afternoon, good evening, hello, 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 wherever and whenever you are listening to our podcast radio show. I am Rob Watson, and welcome to Rated LGBT Radio. Today, as always, we bring you tales and stories and information in the LGBTQ world. Today is kind of a seedy tale of a man who was an activist. He was wealthy, or is wealthy. He gave lots of money to politicians who have dedicated their lives to elevating the lives of LGBTQ citizens and fighting for racial justice. He did not live his life in that way, however. He lived in what was actually kind of depraved and awful behavior, and today, he has finally been taken into custody. So this is really a breaking news story. But his name is Ed Buck, and I'm going to read the statement of facts from his prosecutor. Defendant Ed Buck is a violent, dangerous sexual predator. He mainly preys on men made vulnerable by addiction and homelessness. Using the bait of narcotics, money, and shelter, the defendant lures these vulnerable victims to his home. From his home, in a position of power, Buck manipulates his victims into participating in his sexual fetishes. These fetishes include supplying and personally administering dangerous large doses of narcotics to his victims. Buck aggressively and malevolent behavior led to the death of two men in Buck's apartment, Jamel Moore and Timothy Dean. Not deterred by the senseless deaths of Moore and Dean, the defendant nearly killed a third victim last week. The defendant's predatory acts and conscious disregard for life must be stopped. And today, justice in that regard has begun. On board to discuss this story, as well as some other things happening in the news, we have, of course, my co-host Brody Levesque, but also joining us as special guest, Zach Ford. And Zach is the founder of Fording the River Sticks newsletter, and he is also a former editor of Think Progress. Look forward to talking to both of them, and I'll bring on Brody right away. Good evening, Brody. Good afternoon.
Good evening. Good afternoon. And yeah, it's been one of those news days. There will be a press conference at the United States Courthouse in downtown Los Angeles that begins at 2 o'clock Pacific. Ed Buck, who you just set up the story about, has been transferred by the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department into the custody of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. KTLA, the Los Angeles Times, and the Los Angeles Blade are all reporting that the arraignment that was due to happen Thursday on charges of battery, administering methamphetamine, and maintaining a drug house, which were all state-level charges, was actually continued until October 11th. And this was, of course, from the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office. At some point this afternoon, Buck will be transferred in U.S. District Court for the Central District of California. We're not exactly sure just yet what those charges will be. Law enforcement sources haven't really told us in the press corps yet, but we do know that as we'll be finding out that probably pretty shortly here as the press conference gets underway. We're also going to be discussing a kind of a ripple effect in the LGBTQ media, which has been kind of interesting to say the very least. And Zach and I will be talking with you about that.
Yeah, also let's put some context to that, Brody. That has to do with Pete Buttigieg saying that he does not read LGBTQ media, and that has created that uproar there.
Well, yeah, it's a little bit convoluted in the way that that was phrased. Also happening, Donald Trump was campaigning all of yesterday in California, and he managed to reignite his feud, not only with the state, but with the cities of Los Angeles and San Diego with some of his comments. Journalist Aaron Trupar noted that Trump is essentially beefing with California over environmentalism and homelessness, but Aaron pointed out he's really just lashing out because he's about as popular as cold sores out in California. In Oberlin, Ohio, a Peace Community Baptist church there now has a transgender pastor. Erica Sanders is the first trans woman who has ever been appointed to head up a church, so that's kind of a win for that. Also in California, sad news again, we've had two losses this week. Of course, veteran ABC News journalist and NPR commentator and my friend Cokie Roberts passed away. But one of the earliest deans of the Washington Press Corps, someone that I looked up to listened to when I was a young journalist in my 20s in the 1980s, Sander Van Oker, has passed away. He died Monday night in Santa Barbara, California. Moving along into a couple of other things, we're looking at a very moving and poignant event that occurred earlier today on Capitol Hill in front of the House Ways and Means Committee. A good friend of the show, a good friend of mine and yours, and a survivor of the Pulse nightclub shooting, Brandon Wolf, testified before Chairman John Lewis and the other members of House Ways and Means. His testimony was really, really, really powerful and to the point. And I think it's something that, you know, that apparently there's video up now of it, and I highly recommend that our listeners go. I'm going to take one quote from his testimony this morning, though, which I thought was very appropriate, and I'm quoting Brandon. In America, it feels like we've made a decision. Rather than use every tool in our toolbox to combat hatred, we have chosen instead to subsidize it, embolden it, and hand it an assault weapon. So, which is really kind of true. And tied to Brandon's testimony this morning on the Hill yesterday, Sandy Hook Promise, which is the parents group of survivors of the Sandy Hook Elementary shooting, which killed 21 people, released a very, very powerful and, quite frankly, disturbing PSA to kick off the new school year. And I highly recommend that everybody go and see that PSA. It's pretty powerful. And that's really about it for the day. I do want to do a quick little blurb here, though, before we bring Zach on. Zach is a longtime friend of the show. He's a longtime friend of mine. He's an extremely creative and very talented musician, in addition to the fact that he's probably one of the best journalists in LGBTQ media. Unfortunately, the Center for American Progress, which was the parent organization for Think Progress, for whatever reason, decided that they couldn't sustain the excellent journalism that was going on at Think Progress. And so Zach, last Friday, along with his colleagues, unfortunately, were laid up. But he's got this new gig, and his new gig, I think, is really critically important. And for all of you folks that really want a good, positive, fun-filled, fact-filled, and really excellent newsletter on LGBTQ news stories, go to zachford.substack.com. And it's called Fording the River Styx, and I highly recommend it. Rob?
There we go. So without further ado, let's go ahead and bring Zach on. And Zach, welcome to the show.
Hey, I'm glad to be here and join you all.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So can you take us back on this Ed Buck story? Tell us who he is. And, you know, I don't think many of our listeners have heard the story at all. So if you can take us back to the beginning, that would be really helpful.
Sure. So, you know, Ed Buck is a prominent Democratic donor, lives out in West Hollywood. I'll be honest, I haven't followed his story as close either, so I'm probably not the one who can take us all the way back to share all of the details. But what's really important is that I believe it was just last year, a second young man of color died in his apartment due to a drug overdose. And this really sort of raised the alarm. The one particular journalist, Jeanette, oh my gosh, I wasn't ready for you to ask me right away and I forgot her name. Jasmine Canick, I'm sorry, has really been like trying to track Ed Buck for a long time since the first young man of color died in his apartment. And so when this second death occurred, you know, it really sort of struck a chord that, like, this is a pattern. Some strange stuff is going down there. This is a person that should not be trusted with these young people's lives. And in particular, you know, may be engaging in some criminal activity and should face charges. And so there was actually another individual who overdosed in his apartment, but thankfully survived. And that seemed to be the tipping point for the authorities to finally take action and hold him accountable for how he's been treating these young men.
Brody, do you have any further information on the investigation itself into what's been going on with him and these men?
The Los Angeles County District Attorney, Jackie Lacey, and I spoke about this case when I interviewed her back in March. And it should be also noted that the family of the first victim, Jamal Moore, the young man that was the first overdose, which is how Jasmine Canick and the activists got involved, there was a determination there by Lacey that there wasn't enough evidence to charge Buck criminally. And when I spoke with the DA, she indicated that this was one of the problems and the handicaps that her office was having, and her chief deputy, Craig Hume, was actually the one that made the decision not to prosecute. She signed off on it. Then, as Zach just mentioned, 55-year-old gentleman, Timothy Dean, also a Los Angeles resident, passed away in January of this year, and it became a little bit more of a pile-on, and the DA's office and the Los Angeles County Medical Examiner kept saying that they didn't have anything concrete to charge Buck with. And that just wasn't sitting well with Jasmine and as well as the black activist community. And it didn't sit well with Letitia Nixon, Jamal Moore's mother, the first victim. And so she filed a lawsuit in state court and then later got that transferred, or her attorneys did, in May of this year into federal court. And as a matter of fact, it was just certified and bound over for litigation last week. As Zach just pointed out, I think the tipping point was this other young black individual who experienced a nearly fatal overdose on September the 11th, which was last week, and that managed to get the L.A. County Sheriff's Department and the DA's office off their butts, and they actually now had a living victim, and he's the one that told them that Buck had actually physically injected him. It's the thing that's interesting is there's been charges of racism and malfeasance and everything else, which the district attorney for the county of Los Angeles is black. And Lacey, when I interviewed the DA, she took exception to that because of the fact, you know, obviously she's black, she's African American, she's part of the community. But she kept stressing that without something concrete, there was nothing for her to go on. And the findings from the Los Angeles County Medical Examiner's Office were a little inconclusive. So it was legally, it was a problem. The family just said, you know, that's it. Well, we're going to sue. And then, you know, by happenstance, this third victim. Now, again, I the press conference is going on now as we're on the air. I'm not really sure what the feds are going to charge him with, and it looks, based on the custody release sheet that I just saw before we came on the air, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department released Buck into the custody of the FBI. Normally that is done just prior to federal charges being levied against him. And, you know, I have no idea what those are, but I'm sure they're all basically related around the drugs themselves.
How did Buck engage with these men? Where did he find them? How did he recruit to get them into his apartment?
This has kind of been part of one of the debates that has been going back. Was he using Grindr or some other dating app? Was it word of mouth? We know that the first victim was a sex worker. I have virtually no information on the third victim. Timothy Dean, I believe, was in retail. These are answers that I would hope are going to come out at trial. The Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department substation was less than forthcoming, and when I called the Robbery Homicide Bureau downtown, they weren't very forthcoming either. So I really don't have an answer for you for that.
So, with the charges of racism, was that just the charges of racism around the handling of this case, or was it also charges or accusations of him targeting young African-American men?
The racism charge was being leveled by the activists. And, Zach, you probably followed Jasmine's stuff a little bit more closely than I did. But it looked like that the main argument here was that Buck, being a Democratic fundraiser and a white guy, was white privileged, and that the district attorney's office was using that as a vehicle, and that's where the racism came out of. It's like, this guy's not being charged because he's wealthy, he's white. Ironically, Buck is not a wealthy individual at all whatsoever, and he's not... He's more of what I would call and I'm probably not using the right term here, he facilitates as a fundraiser. In other words, it's not his money, but he's able to get people, he's a conduit, more or less, for these funds. So, and of course, most of the people in the circles that he was in are all white and very privileged, some of whom stroke big checks to Lacey, who herself is a Democrat. So I think that was the genesis for it. I think the other part of it was the racism being leveled in terms of charges and the perception of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department and the way they were handling the case. It was kind of one of these paraphrasing, oh, it's another dead black kid, they're not going to care.
Right.
Yeah,
Jeffrey King. Go ahead, Zach.
I was just going to say the other piece of this, too, is that conservatives are actually trying to attack Democrats by, you know, saying, oh, he was a Democratic activist. People were trying to cover for him. I don't know anyone that was trying to cover for him. I think, as Brody said, you know, this was the challenge of how much more conspicuous do you need than two different young black men dying in his apartment to actually pursue charges against him? So I don't know anybody that's like upset that he got caught. I think we all have just been wondering when that's going to happen. And so now it looks like he's finally going to face justice.
Yeah, and I did want to read the quote from Jeffrey King, who's the black executive director of the Meantime Men. And he commented on the racism aspect. Quote, that's part of the bigger issue here. That guy, Buck, was treated like a respectable citizen. But a drug-related accident occurred in a man's house. He should have been taken down to the station and questioned at a minimum. This is a matter of race on a minimum level. The value of this kid's life is not the same as a prominent person's child. He would have been handled differently. The police would have been relentless. The DA would have been relentless. The whole system would have been relentless, King said. So that's the kind of the perception of how the treatment was much more guarded, presumably because he wasn't a person of color. Brody, any comment on that?
I mean, the problem with this, and I think Zach would agree because we've seen this before, there is a perception that at a certain strata or level, okay, that the privilege, you know, pardon the pun, trumps all. And I think that especially in the case of Buck, and particularly when you're talking about pocket communities like West Hollywood, where Buck lives, you know, it's a gayborhood or it's had a nickname, Boys Town. That, you know, it's like, well, they're going to insulate. And once the politics get into it, particularly with the progressive politicians, it's like, well, you know, obviously, this is what's happening here. And I, you know, the Buck case, I don't think is isolated, and Zach can correct me if I'm wrong, in terms of that perception being out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we have a lot of insular communities. There might be an instinct to protect our own, but I don't know that that's happening so much as it was really just these perceptions of socioeconomic status and race and maybe some degree of politics just protecting him from proper accountability.
Yeah.
So I wanted to follow up on the political aspect of that, Zach, you were mentioning. So the conservatives are using this as a pressure point and degrading Democrats who receive money that presumably Buck handled, even though it may not even have come from him directly. What do you think the blowback on that is going to be? Are people putting aside that money? What's happening there?
I'm not sure. And to Brody's point, I don't know how sizable the sums of money are. I haven't done the research on that to know for sure. I don't know that the blowback is going to be that severe. I think this is something conservatives try to do every time because they have so many terrible people in their ranks. You know, just another Republican lawmaker in Pennsylvania this week caught with child porn, you know, and you say, oh, of course it was a Republican, because we're so used to sort of hearing that narrative from the people who so often preach the very righteous social morals. So, you know, I think it's always just an attempt to kind of get back at us that we do have some terrible people who happen to be liberal and support our causes. But I think what's telling is how often we're the same ones saying, yeah, we want to get rid of him too, or we want to hold him accountable as well. So, you know, I don't know that it's a significant thing that's going to blow up. I think a lot more people are just relieved that he's finally in custody.
Yeah.
I would agree.
You were mentioning that, yeah, the federal prosecutors are now after him. What is the difference between the state going after him versus the federal? What line did he cross that put him in their hairs instead?
I mean, I've been talking to sources in the U.S. Attorney's Office trying to determine, and they're being very tight-lipped about this. The most that we're getting out of them is drug related. So there's got to be something in there because it's methamphetamine. In virtually every one of these cases, methamphetamine was directly involved. And because methamphetamine can either be made locally in laboratories, a la Breaking Bad type of thing, in most cases it's coming in from somewhere else. You know, by volume into that part of California. So that would involve the feds if it was coming in from, say, labs in Arizona or even from Mexico. You know, so there may be another angle to this that the feds are looking at. They may also be looking at, you know, he may have deprived them of civil rights or other rights. It's hard to say, you know. It's really difficult until we get a determination from the U.S. attorney as to what their thought processes are here. And it should be noted, they're going after him, okay, for more than just the drugs. You know, the state charges were all drug related, but the feds are actually going in terms of at least the death of Jamal Moore. So I'm beginning to suspect that there's probably something else, you know, in the equation that's got the U.S. attorney involved.
And are there, obviously these two young men died and one almost did. Were there other people that have come forward saying that, you know, they were taken in and, you know, they ended up walking away, but that he was, you know, what kind of drug games was he reputed to have been playing with these guys?
According to what we've been told and what we have previously reported on, he was injecting methamphetamine and making there was a particular type of opiate, and I'm not going to say because I just have a blank here for a second, but it was the methamphetamine mostly, and then the other part of this was the accusations were being leveled that he was trading this for sex. And a significant amount of the foot traffic into his apartment were, in fact, young black sex workers. So, you know, that's the other aspect of it. I'm getting a feed through now. Federal authorities are accusing Buck of distributing methamphetamine. Now, there are federal charges that go with that. An allegation which is supplemented to by the 2017 death of Jamal Moore. So, yeah, they're tying the death and the distribution of methamphetamine to it is what they're doing. He was transferred into federal custody at 1:30 this afternoon Pacific.
And I think to your question, Rob, you know, there have been some other people who have started to speak out a little bit about the just sort of manipulative way that he tried to take advantage of these people who were particularly vulnerable. And part of that involved getting them addicted on these drugs so that they would have a dependency on him and capitalizing on it that way. So, you know, it paints a picture of a very sick individual, but someone who also very systematically went after these people to make them his victims.
Yeah. And Zach, what has been the reaction within the LGBTQ press? And they're a subject we're going to go on to in just a minute. But how have they picked up this story and positioned it?
From what I've read, it's mostly just matter of fact. You know, I'm not sure how close many people were following it. I think, folks like Jasmine, who were on the ground in Hollywood and connected to the families and people who, you know, have suffered as a result of his actions were much more pressing it. And so I think a lot of folks, you know, myself included, peripherally knew that this had happened, knew that for some reason charges weren't being pressed. And so for a lot of folks, it's just a good, the bad guy got. And just sort of appreciating that, you know, this is somebody who was hurting members of our community. He might himself be a member of it, but he's still a bad guy, and he's not going to be doing harm to anybody else any further.
Right. No, good thing. Good thing. Brody, any other final words on this at this time that we need to...
I mean, essentially at this time, we're just kind of waiting for the feds to, you know, make their determination. And again, the press conference is ongoing right now in Los Angeles. And so I think what we're waiting to see is, you know, what direction the feds decide to go with this. And, you know, at that point, you know, federal prosecutors at this point have charged him with providing meth to a man who died of an overdose. And outside of that, we don't have any other information. I think that if folks would like some further information, obviously the Los Angeles Blade will be your source for that. My colleague and dear friend Karen Oakham will be covering the story, and obviously our colleagues at the New York Times, NBC Out, The Advocate, and Out Magazine, Nico Lang and his crew will be covering it as well. And I'm pretty certain that Zach will be covering it in his newsletter. Again, that's you know, fording the River Styx. So, yeah.
Excellent. So, shifting gears a little bit, I guess it's now about a week and a half ago, we had the Democratic debate. And in that debate, candidate Peter Buttigieg made history by being the very first candidate on the stage of a presidential debate to discuss his coming out story as a gay person. Fast forward to the past few days, he did an interview on Cyrus Radio and made a comment about not really reading the LGBTQ press. And that has created a little bit of a stir, let's put it that way. Brody, you want to take us into what all is going on there?
There has been some commentary in the LGBTQI media, and they hung their hat on the one thing that Mayor Buttigieg said, which was he wasn't reading LGBTQ media. And that immediately elicited some fairly negative reactions, including write-up pieces in Out Magazine, The Advocate, and a tremendous amount of discussion. I saw a tweet this morning from an Out journalist that I didn't retweet. Instead, I took a screenshot of the tweet. I put it up, and then I even asked a question about that on my own personal Facebook page just to get some sort of reaction to it. And it ranges from people who are extremely butthurt to people who are going, "Are you kidding me?" and anywhere in between. And I'm going to let Zach talk a little bit more about this because, you know, in full transparency and disclosure, you know, to our listeners, I am not a member of the LGBTQI press. So in some instances, I can give you my impression as a mainstream editor and reporter of what I see, but I'm not in the trenches in the day-to-day grind like Zach is. I did notice that there seemed to be a question that was being raised, and I think it is a legitimate question, is that was he not reading the LGBTQI press because of the fact that there were several publications who I'm not going to name, Zach, if you want to, please feel free, I'm just not going to, that slammed him, okay, in the way he came about and coming out. And they were, their coverage, quite frankly, I found salacious and specious. And it was, "You're not gay enough." Which seems to be the go-to for some of these news organizations in the LGBTQI media. And I'm not exactly sure where the definition of "you're not gay enough" is supposed to fit into all of this. The other thing that I noticed was that this is really causing kind of, once again, a little bit more of divisiveness and polarity, because the question really starts to be asked, and I've seen this happen time and time again, is exactly what is the role of the LGBTQI media, and are they fulfilling that role, or are they, you know, pandering to a very small group, or are they pandering to a certain sect, or are they even doing the job they're supposed to be doing, and especially if they're turning around, and as one commentator put it to me in a private text message, "Yeah, they're busy pissing on gay guys. Who's next?" So I don't know. Zach, I'm really going to let you have this one because, as I just said, I'm not a member of the gay media, and I'm not really comfortable, you know, trying to do an insider's out on this one because I don't deal with it day in, day out like you do. And I can only give you my perceptions from the outside looking in.
Sure. You know, I think that this hits home for me a lot because for the better part of a decade, I've exclusively been writing, except for a little bit, about LGBTQ issues. And I think that the LGBTQ media is a really important thing because so often our issues are sidelined because our community is thought of as being small, it's thought of as being kind of spread out or just concentrated in only a couple specific places and not as important. But at the same time, you know, especially for the trans community, but the whole LGBTQ community, we've been backsliding quite a bit. The Trump administration has done a lot to hurt us. They've done a lot to dismantle trans protections, and public opinion on our progress is also declining. So, you know, we have a lot of work that we need to be doing. And there was just a new report out this week showing that mainstream media's coverage of LGBTQ issues has significantly declined over the past couple of years. So there are fewer of us left, and we have less of a platform, and we're fighting to kind of keep people aware about what's happening to the queer community. So I think it's really, really important. And what I think is also important about the context of Pete Buttigieg's comments here is, yes, he was talking about the way that some outlets have tried to police his sexuality and his gender, but they haven't been queer publications. They've been mainstream progressive publications that sometimes cover queer issues. I mean, I think the most egregious example was the New Republic piece that Dale Peck wrote that called him Mary Pete and, you know, kind of compared him to an Uncle Tom and really was over the top and was eventually retracted. But, you know, there were some other outlets that wrote about, you know, how are we perceiving his sexual orientation and gender? And they weren't the queer outlets. So he's kind of blaming the queer outlets. And where I really struggle is he's saying it in a sort of a derisive way as if that's all that we're capable of, that we're sort of, you know, these catty commentators who aren't doing real reporting, who aren't really doing an important task of covering queer issues. And that's where I'm really struggling. You know, it's one thing if Pete Buttigieg doesn't identify a lot with his sexuality. I think that's fine. Not all of us identify in the same way. Not all of us connect to the community in the same way. And, you know, we can talk about what that means in terms of him being in such a visible spotlight as a presidential contender, but it's not really our place to police this is how he should live his life or how he should feel about things. But it does become an issue if he starts saying that the queer media doesn't have value when we're already struggling. And so I think that's why this particular comment has struck such a chord, because it suggests that he's not just indifferent to the queer community, but a little bit spiteful for some reason.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, Zach, is I guess one of the things that occurs to me is when people rise to the level that he has in terms of visibility, and Donald Trump has really run completely counter to this, but there is an issue of you drop a pebble in the water and it really balloons out in a way that previously you could say things that did not have that kind of impact. I mean, this was a side comment, you know, in a conversation. It wasn't, you know, meant to be him coming out with a headline commentary on the LGBTQ press itself. But I can also see the need for him in terms of what he is doing with, you know, being on a stage where he has to become the homogenous politician that, you know, makes everybody in America believe that he is not just representing one specific group, but that he is there for everyone. And I mean, that's a history that goes back to John F. Kennedy, where John F. Kennedy had to do the exact same thing about being Catholic, because there was the scuttlebutt that, you know, if he became president, you know, that all he would care about were the Catholics. And at that time, that was a big deal. I mean, it was, you know, the Protestant and the Catholic divide was a huge thing in our country. But I think your point is valid, you know, that the specific articles that he was probably alluding to were actually ironically not in the LGBTQ publications, but they were by LGBTQ writers, which to me is one thing that as a consumer of the LGBTQ press, I would observe. Because I've been, you know, from the 80s when I was very young, you know, absorbing everything I could find. And at the time, the LGBTQ press was not online. It was, you know, printed publications that you picked up in a bar and, you know, reading stories that you couldn't read nowhere else because they weren't being picked up by mainstream media at all. And today, quite frankly, much of the LGBT news that I read, I do read out of mainstream media because it is presented in a way that is much more directly factual. And we do have LGBT press who present that way, but much of it has become very directive in terms of the article is not presented, you know, as what's going on, but is, you know, the author of the article is literally telling you how to feel about it. And even in cases where I agree with the author and where they're going with it, I really like to hear the information so I can make up my own mind. So I think there's some elements of that as well.
I really want to just jump in because you've triggered a number of different things in what you just said. You know, part of what I really struggle with, you know, particularly having just worked for 8.5 years at a progressive publication that couldn't find a funder to keep it afloat, is we don't value progressive perspective news on the left in the same way that conservatives have just factories churning out everything that reinforces their talking points. And I think that that really is detrimental to those of us who are trying to move this country in a progressive direction. And so, you know, I hear what you're saying, that there are, you know, some writers who are trying to direct you to take their opinion or feel a certain way. But I think that there's something important about that. You know, we want to sort of have the objective perspective, but there's also a whole lot of really awful both siding that happens when you do that. And for people to say, hey, here's this important thing, I'm going to equip you with all the information, but like, I also want to contextualize it so that you understand how you should really feel about this and how you should be talking about it. I think that's an important thing that we should be doing. And the other thing to keep in mind is that when we're queer people writing for a queer audience, part of what we're also doing is having a conversation among ourselves. And sometimes we're going to dig into topics that maybe aren't meant for a mainstream audience, or that are better geared to how we're going to have these conversations in our own communities. And I think there's a really important place for that too. So what I kind of hear from Mayor Pete, and maybe even a little bit from you, Rob, is this sense of derision that, like, if you don't feel connected to that, or you're not already part of the conversation, it's not meant for you. And I think that's just really sad, because I think so many of us are writing specifically to try to reach people who don't necessarily feel connected, who don't necessarily feel, you know, if they're a gay man, that the bar scene is for them, or if they're just, you know, a queer woman, that there's anything out there connecting them at all. We want to invite you in, but we also want to equip you with how to talk about these issues that maybe are new to you. So I think all of that is really important, and just sort of casting it aside as being biased is sort of ignoring that there's not an equilibrium in the media sphere politically. There's all this stuff that's spewing toxic drivel and fake news on the right, and we do need to kind of better equip our readers on the left.
I don't disagree with that. In terms of equipping readers, and here's full disclosure, Brody's in my history, where we started out our friendship, was Brody was a senior editor of a very large LGBTQ publication, and Brody's side presented news that was of interest to the LGBT community, but it was done in a very factual way. I mean, you read the article, you got the facts. I was on board as that commentator. I was the voice you're talking about, Zach, where I was presenting the LGBTQ experience, but that was my umbrella. That was what I was there to do. I was presenting, you know, commentary and from the life of an LGBTQ person, I presented you exactly who I was and the perspective that I was bringing to it. I was not presenting what I wrote about in terms of I'm covering objective facts here. And I think that's, you know, we're maybe splitting hairs, but in some of the things that are presented, that those lines have been blurred. Where I'm not able to get the facts. And the part that really has been difficult for me is not even the fact that the facts are commented on, but in many cases, articles are the core of the article is something that is actually not very germane to LGBTQ experience at all, but is blown up for clickbait to be alarmist and sensationalized and given added context and speculation on how it could possibly damage LGBTQ people when that isn't what is actually the fact. I mean, it's become bigger and bigger than it was before. Because and I think it's due to the fact that many of the big LGBTQ issues are presented in the mainstream media. And I do get because I was reading the same article where you were talking about, you know, in terms of the coverage of LGBTQ issues has gone way down since the Trump administration. And I think some of that, due to the numbers, has to do with the Trump administration itself. I mean, they have just jammed the pipeline with their sensationalism. I mean, he's trying to create news stories every day. So it's like where, you know, he creates a news cycle in one day. And a lot of it has nothing to do with LGBTQ issues. Therefore, our numbers that make it, you know, get diluted just by attrition.
Well, I think that one of the things that I, you know, and I'm going to, there's one little footnote I want to put on what you just said. In the case of Trump, I think it's, you know, especially with his tweeting pattern, you know, it's not just a daily thing. He could do it within an hour. To Zach's point, and I'm going to run a couple comments here, and Zach knows these people, as do I really well. Jamie McGonigal is a voiceover artist and an LGBTQ activist. And in full disclosure, he and his husband, Sean, are a friend. And they live in the D.C. area. And as a part of the thread of the discussion that Zach, you and I are having, this was Jamie's reflection answering another commentator for the Washington Blade, Pete Rosenstein. This is Jamie. There's this expectation, though, that he, Karen, Mayor Buttigieg, should help promote LGBTQ media while LGBTQ media treats him far worse than any other media. I'm pretty sure he's aware at any time he mentions anything regarding being gay, LGBTQ media is going to spin it in some absurd way. Now, the next commentator is an activist of note. His name is Michael Crawford, and I'm going to read Michael's comment. Y'all do realize that he's running for president and not sitting poolside at Fire Island. He's got a hell of a lot of things to do and figure out as he's trying to win the Democratic nomination to challenge Trump for the highest office in the country. That doesn't leave a lot of time to read what folks are saying about him in the queer media. We are so myopic sometimes, it drives me nuts. There's so much work to be done to defend our hard-won gains over the years, and even more work to be done to move forward. And folks are mad that Pete isn't reading The Advocate or Out. This brouhaha makes no damn sense. The last word comes from a blogger from South Carolina and a dear friend of mine, Alvin McEwen. Here's Alvin's comment. If it's about his coming out process, then I sympathize. I unfriended several gay folk who attacked him because of how he told the story of his coming out and attacked him for being a white man who may appeal to some conservatives. I felt that they were forgetting the difference between calling out an unfair system and personally attacking our own. No one has the right to dictate how your coming out story should be told. I have long maintained, and this is one critique that I have long had, is that sometimes to me as an outsider, because I am, and I'm looking at it, that sometimes the queer press, gay press, however you want to label it, and the gay movement in general has a nasty habit of eating its own. And to Alvin's point, you know, I think that one of the things that we need to consider in a situation like this is what exactly is the greater good. The one thing that I appreciate about writers like Zach and folks in queer media is that they give an authentic voice to the LGBTQI community that it's not possible for myself or other mainstream editors and journalists to do. We can't do it. All right. So that is that needed voice. It's that authenticity. The flip side of that, as Jamie pointed out, and I agree with Jamie, in some cases, this goes back to the eating your own and eating your young, however you want to phrase the cliche. And I've seen them do that as well in queer media. So the question therefore becomes, well, what's the best balance? So at the end of the day, are we really criticizing Pete for being gay and the way he decided to declare that on the stage of the Democratic debates? Or are we criticizing the fact that there were a couple of publications that went to town on him because their editorial crew or their journalists didn't approve of it? And in this particular case, as Zach pointed out, it wasn't even the queer media that started this. I believe Slate Magazine was one of the guilty offenders. I'll go ahead and say it. I think Slate was one of them.
Right.
Granted, the writers were gay. Okay. But, you know, this becomes the question. And this has always been my longstanding, you know, critique of it. There are those that have accused me of being too much of a Puritan when it comes down to journalistic standards and ethics. And maybe I am. I'm a fossil, and I'll admit to it. I've been doing this for four decades. So, you know, for me, my perspective is different. And again, and as I tell people, I'm a journalist who happens to be gay, but I am not a gay journalist. And so when we get into discussions like this, this is why I'm very comfortable handing it to Zach, because this is his line. It's not mine.
Well, and I think what's important to keep in mind here is that, you know, because we don't have a lot of queer people in the mainstream, we're often having conversations among ourselves. But when we have someone who rises to some level of influence where they are part of the mainstream, you know, then we have to, then we have conversations. How are they representing us? And what are they doing on our behalf? Right? Because it's not often that it happens. I think that's why, you know, Ellen, for example, whenever she makes the slightest misstep, is really criticized quickly by the queer press, because it's sort of like, well, you're one of the only people out there, and you made this very clear mistake that, you know, if you'd been reading us and checking in with us, you wouldn't have done. You know, that's why we're quick to jump. Now, a presidential candidate, their whole job is to convince everyone that they're for everyone. So no matter how you identify, each one of these candidates is out there trying to make you feel like they're going to be the one who best serves your interest. But for us, we also see, hey, this is like the first time, sorry, Fred Karger, I'm just not counting you because it was a joke. This is the first time that there's a real candidate who actually like has any semblance of a chance of, you know, at least advancing his political career, even if he doesn't win the actual presidency through this, and really shaping things on a level that no queer person has before. And I think it's totally reasonable to look at him from within our community and say, okay, is he doing right by us? Because he's the only one out there. And yeah, a lot of people are going to try to project on him how they think he should tell his story and what his life should have been. And I don't think that's okay. But when it comes to how he's representing us, and is he lifting us up along with him, I think that's a valid question. And I think a lot of those lines get conflated along the way. And that's sort of why we're having conversations like this. But we need to recognize that we're still a minority. We're still subject to a lot of oppression. We still have a lot of people who do not accept us as normal and part of the mainstream. And so we have to work together to figure out how we, you know, counteract that and continue to move forward. And that's why you're going to have such scrutiny for somebody in a position like this. But if he's just willing to sort of throw us under the bus because he didn't like the way that conversation was happening, you know, that's not okay. That's a problem, because now it's somebody out there who's seen as a representative of the queer community, because there are so few of us, who's now not actually representing the queer community. So it's a real challenge. And I think Mayor Pete's a pretty decent guy, and I have no issue with his story and how he tells his sexuality. But I was triggered by this statement because it suggested that he wasn't thinking about how he could lift us up. He was thinking about how we were getting in his way, because I don't believe in the whole circular firing squad or eating our own thing. I think what we all try to do is hold each other to a higher standard and hold each other accountable for what we say we're going to do or what we believe in. And if he just doesn't like that or doesn't want to be a part of that conversation, that's one thing. But to throw us under the bus over it is quite another.
Zach, do you feel like the scrutiny of a gay person, LGBTQ person, with our quote unquote community drives less loyalty than other minority groups? And the reason I ask that is that I think about other candidates who run, and I know people who jump on board because it's like, oh my God, this is the first, fill in the blank. And I haven't detected that level of loyalty with him. And maybe that's just the people I know. But what is your perspective on that?
I think it goes both ways. I mean, I can't go to a gay bar in D.C. without seeing at least one boot edge T-shirt. So I do get the sense that there are a lot of people who are excited by his candidacy because he's gay. I do think that people should think about who's going to be the best president and not necessarily just who's going to be the most representative. But there's still something really important about seeing somebody on that debate stage talking about that issue, but talking about any other issue and being seen as a real contender. So, I don't think any conversation in any community about loyalty is right to have. I think it's just we're all trying to figure out in our own ways, do we feel motivated because we see him up there? Do we feel like this is something that we need to sort of hang as many ornaments on the tree as possible to kind of make the most that he's up there? There's so many different approaches and none of them is particularly wrong. It just becomes complicated when emotions come into it or when we just feel like we're not on a level playing field having the conversation.
Right. Excellent. Well, Zach, thank you so much for joining us today. Your insight is very valuable and we really appreciate everything you do and your thoughts on this. Brody, also, thank you for everything you do and putting all this together and your work and history and contribution. I also want to thank our listeners who have listened in. You're making us a very popular podcast, and we really appreciate it. Also, tell your friends that on any smartphone on the podcast app, they can click on that, do a search for Rated LGBT Radio, and subscribe. We really appreciate it, and we are here for you. We will be back again next week with another exciting topic, and please listen in and download that podcast/show as well. Also, out in Santa Cruz is on Saturday nights, 7 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Eastern time, and you can listen to that on www.ksco.com. And again, we want to highlight Zach's publication. Zach, you want to give us a quick place, where do they find that?
Sure. So Fording the River Styx is a daily roundup of queer political news that you get right in your inbox. It's free. You can go to zachford.substack.com. I also put up a short link, bit.ly/fording. Ford, like my last name, Fording, like fording the river on the Oregon Trail. And or just follow me on Twitter, and I post every issue when it comes out there as well.
Perfect. Thanks so much. And everybody have a great day. And we will see you next time.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.